Okay, good morning. We're going to get started and keep getting your coffee, rugalach, etc. Conversion probably is the single greatest issue that caused my dad to found the Institute, if I may speak for him. I think that the issue, it's something that he's been writing about. His first article ever in Tradition in 1971 was on Rabbi Uziel on conversion. And he's written articles galore, a book, and has dealt with both people he's converted himself and has given advice to who knows how many people around the world, particularly in America, trying to navigate the conversion process. I find it amazing. I find adult conversion just amazing. I mean, I have the privilege of working with several back in my rabbi days, and in terms of just people who I admire, when you get an adult who's going through this process of transformation, it's amazing. You know, as an adult, I think it's amazing when a Jewish couple adopts a baby and converts that child. But that's a different. I don't admire the baby. I admire the parents for adoption. But when you're dealing with adult conversion, even in the case of a dating situation, it's unbelievable to watch the non-Jewish partner and often the Jewish partner going through a fundamental journey. Now that I get to be national scholar, so this past Shabbat I was in Kansas City. A bunch of weeks ago I was in Memphis, and then I got to meet, from my point of view, like real converts. These are people who grew up as Christians. There was a Christian couple that I met this past weekend. They're both Christian. Nobody, you know, there wasn't one Jew and one non-Jew, which was something that I was more used to in New York. They were both Christian. They went to their church, and the church believed in understanding the biblical roots of Christianity, and they started reading, and they started reading, and they started reading. And before you know it, they said, you know, we both want to be Jews. And they started this unbelievable journey as a religious Christian couple, and they are still in the process as we speak. And it was just unbelievable hearing stories of real conversions. Here's one big difference between America and Israel, or anywhere in Israel. There are many differences between anywhere in Israel. One of them is that in America or Europe or wherever conversions take place, typically speaking, it's an individual. It's a case-by-case basis where one person wants to convert today. Right? In Israel, you're dealing with a national situation where you'll have literally hundreds of thousands of people who have come from the former Soviet Union who are not halachically Jewish. Their father's Jewish, their mother's not Jewish. Neither of their parents is Jewish, whatever it is. But they emigrated with large-scale numbers of halachic Russian Jews. Most of them are not observant, but these are people who pay taxes in Israel. Their children go fight in the army. They're serving the people of Israel in every genuine sense. And you can't convert them one by one, because no matter how many bate din you have, and no matter how good the court system is, and there are problems with it, you read any Institute publications, you'll find out, oh boy, are there problems. But even without the Institute, there are real problems. But even if everybody were good and doing what they need to do, there's just no way to deal with 300,000 or so people as individuals. You have to figure out national style solutions to national issues, because if you don't, these people are still marrying each other. So it's intermarriage, right? You want to be able to prevent that. You want to be able to raise their children as Jews. We have real issues on our plate, and we need to be able to deal with them. So this is going to be a two-pronged plan. We only have 2 weeks left, so conversion is going to dominate most of the remainder of this course. Today we're going to deal with the ancient sources on the subject, and then next week we're going to move into the sea changes that have taken place since the 19th century, when many Jews began to assimilate, and the founding of non-Orthodox movements, and then also the founding of the State of Israel. Like, those changes are so enormous that they've completely changed the game plan, and we have to figure out how to best apply the ancient rules to today, what we've been discussing for the last several weeks, but now particularly in the realm of conversion. There are three commandments to love in the Torah. Who do we need to love? We need to love God. We need to love our neighbor. And the third one, the stranger. The Torah goes out of its way. Of the three entities we need to love, God isn't a person. We need to love God. We need to love our fellow Jew, or our fellow Israelite, but we also need to love our stranger. And that's in source number one. Right? When a stranger resides you in your land, you shall not wrong him. The stranger who resides with you shall be to you as one of your citizens. You shall love him as yourself. It's an amazing commandment right there in the book of Leviticus, that not only do we love our neighbor as ourself, but we need to love the stranger as ourself. For you are strangers in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. The Torah makes perfectly clear that we have to love strangers as much as we love ourselves. Now, In halakha, meaning biblical writings, none of them distinguish between two categories of ger, which is the Hebrew word for stranger. Halakha distinguishes between two types of ger. One is called a ger toshav, good morning. There you go. A ger toshav, meaning a resident alien. This is somebody who acculturates into the people of Israel but never joins the nation. They simply have to be monotheists and good people, and they're welcome to be there. That's a ger toshav, a resident alien. And then there's what's called a ger tzedek, which is what you and I today colloquially call a convert, somebody who actually becomes Jewish. So again, the Tanakh doesn't make a distinction between this and that type of ger, presumably because the process of entering the people of Israel was less formal in the biblical period. By the way, it was much easier if you were a woman, not just because you did not need to go through circumcision, which a man did, but for a much bigger reason. A female resident alien could enter the people immediately as soon as she marries an Israelite man. Suddenly she has a land, she has a family, she's a landed person, she has a family clan. A woman would be immediately naturalized and integrated into the people in the biblical period. Whereas a man never owns land because all land in Israel belonged to the 12 tribes. So they could have businesses, they could marry Israelite women, but then they still would never have their own parcel of homestead to call their own. They would have to always be on the margins of society. Men could never fully enter. And their sons could not fully enter. Their daughters always could for the same reason. Their daughters would be able to marry Israelite men, and then they become part of the tribe that you would never notice. Whereas the man never would be able to have land. It's a very important social distinction of the biblical period when nearly all of the people of Israel lived in the land of Israel. Okay, so that's part one. So we have to love the stranger, and the Torah itself doesn't distinguish between resident aliens and halachic converts. It's only in the rabbinic period, when most of Jews did not live in the land of Israel anymore, that you needed to have a formal halachic process that you and I are much more familiar with, where there was a concept of full-scale conversion, where somebody had to go to a Beit Din and have a conversation and then go through some process which led to conversion, okay? So we understand it in rabbinic lens, but it's important to always understand the biblical side of things. Now, what happens when somebody converts? What changes? What does change? What needs to change for somebody to convert? The soul has to change on some level, whatever that means, but yes, okay, what changes? Or what needs to change for somebody?
Keeping kosher.
Their allegiance has to change. They need to feel that they're part of the Jewish people. What else, Lucia, what were you saying?
Keeping kosher.
Yeah, the observance. Living a Jewish life is different from living a non-Jewish life. Huh? So some mitzvot, correct, observance, kashrut, but not just keeping kosher. The whole gamut theoretically changes. Not just theoretically. So your nationhood changes, your observance changes, your beliefs are likely to change. It's possible, especially today, that you can have somebody who was a monotheist before and continues to be a monotheist now. It's easier now than in the olden days where everybody pretty much was pagan. But for example, the most common thing is if somebody comes from a Christian home and wants to convert, so you need to make sure not only are they going to live a Jewish lifestyle, but they need to renounce Christianity. They need to feel, they need to understand what are the differences and what are they not going to think anymore in case they did beforehand. Obviously, it makes a big difference between a religious Christian and somebody who was born into a Christian home but never believed in Christianity. But all the same, there has to be a clear-cut understanding of some form of belief. I'm talking about now, meaning the rabbinic period and on. That's where we're going to be at for the rest of the day. What we know from the biblical period is the nationhood piece, the fact that there's some form of allegiance. I think Elisa said it very well. And there's also this element of naturalization into the people. In the rabbinic period, there had to be an acceptance of Judaism in a fuller sense, and we have to talk about what that fuller sense is. Here's an interesting question. You have a blessing that we recite all the time, Eloheinu ve'Elohei Avoteinu, God and the God of our ancestors. We say this in the Amidah, we say this in all kinds of prayers, God and the God of our ancestors. Should a convert say that if it's not really their ancestors?
Yes. They've now accepted to be part of the people.
So what George is saying is that we have to be able to understand what it really means to convert. It's not just beliefs and observances and nationhood and mitzvot. It's fundamental identity. We need to understand that conversion means, and in fact, halakha views it as a rebirth. You think born again came from Christians? No, they got it from us, like many other things. And in this case, it's halakhically viewed as a rebirth. And it's as though you start all over again. And even formally, we call men, we say that so-and-so becomes son of Abraham, and a woman becomes daughter of Sarah. We actually name them halakhically. We say that now you're literally part of the family. There actually was an ancient debate. What George takes for granted, and by the way, just to preface this point, George is 100% correct, right? But even though...
Always.
Occasionally.
But even though George is 100% correct, there actually was a dissenting view on how to view the identity change, and we'll see that in sources 2 and 3.
And for the fourth...
Come, let's read the sources, then you'll see.
Before I go far, yeah. Just ask a question. You talked about renunciation of Christianity. Islam really tracks a lot of what is in the Old Testament.
Sure.
Does one also have to renounce Islam as well, or any other religion?
Any other religion,
any
correct.
Other religion.
In other words, it's easier for a monotheist to, in other words, Islam is a fully monotheistic religion, no ifs, ands, or buts. So it's easier from that point of view for a Muslim to convert to Judaism.
So actually, you actually have a renunciation provision or something, they say it, or it's just something that comes out from the...
What we have to talk about what the process, that's part of the process question. But there's no question that, in other words, one cannot continue to be a believing Muslim and convert to Judaism. If one wants to be a believing Muslim, that's fine. They could stay that way. But that's not a conversion to Judaism. But we have to talk about what it actually entails. There's a rule that if you have first fruits, you're supposed to bring them to the what became Jerusalem, the capital city, or wherever the shrine might be, and you have to make a proclamation or a confession in source number 2. This is still in the Tanakh. In the Torah itself, you shall go to the priest in charge at that time and say to him, I acknowledge this day before the Lord, your God, that I've entered the land that the Lord swore to our fathers to assign us. It's all part of this understanding. This is my land and this is my ancestral plot, and it belongs to what God gave to our ancestors, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. So the Mishnah, the earliest layer of rabbinic law, teaches in source number 3, these bring bikurim, but do not make the recital. The proselyte, since he cannot say that the Lord swore to our fathers to assign us. There is a Mishnah which says that a convert doesn't fully change identity. In other words, that person becomes Jewish, but that individual, according to this Mishnah, does not say God of our ancestors because it's not your ancestors. So you actually have in a very ancient rabbinic teaching and a very authoritative one, that in this case, that a convert doesn't fully become reborn. Yes, the person is obligated in all the mitzvot, Jewish beliefs, as part of the community, we welcome them. But according to this Mishnah, you still can't say that Abraham and Sarah are your ancestors. You can say, I accept the religion of Abraham and Sarah. I accept the religion of the Torah. But that's still different from saying that you fully transformed. So in the medieval period, somebody wrote a letter to Rambam, because Rambam is always going to show up. You all know that by now. Somebody named Ovadia, who was a convert to Judaism, he asked Rambam, do I say in the Amidah, God and God of my ancestors? He asked exactly this question. So Rambam writes back to Ovadia, the convert, in source number 4. Here's one of his letters that he wrote. You should recite everything as it is and do not change anything, whether alone or in public. The critical point is that it was Abraham, our father, who taught the entire nation, who gave them wisdom and battled against idolatry. Thus, anyone who converts is a disciple of Abraham, our father. Thus, you should say, our God and God of our ancestors. There is no difference here between us and you. So Rambam doesn't rule like the Mishnah. Rambam says a convert is 100% Jewish, and we say that God and God of my ancestors. You have absolutely transformed. So what George said is in fact the law, and Rambam takes for granted. Elsewhere in this letter, he says, he quotes the Mishnah in Bikurim, you can't ignore a Mishnah. He says that's a minority opinion. It's not the law. It's not the authoritative law. Rambam says that the law is that a convert is absolutely Jewish, and that we can say son of Abraham, son of Sarah, and he understands it's not DNA. He says we're all disciples of Abraham and Sarah.
So you're looking at it from the convert's perspective. In other words, his family may not perceive themselves to be, part of the God of Abraham, but you are looking at them and saying, I perceive you to be that.
Exactly, it's an absolute transformation because of the convert's perspective, Jack. Okay. Let me just... Yeah, Benjamin? Right.
So, from
they are from Abraham, but they still don't practice. Of course, they're biologically from Abraham, but they're not practicing our religion. So they're not going to be reciting the Amidah or going through all of these declarations. But you're right, of course, there are other descendants of Abraham out there. We are all cousins. On some level, but in other words, the point is that Abraham and Sarah mark a new era, and the Torah certainly marks that new era. In other words, there's a nationhood within the world community, and that's what Israel is. Right? Indeed, they were on some level. Exactly right. So that all being said, so point number one is that conversion is more than the sum of its parts. Conversion is not just the acceptance of Judaism, beliefs, observances, nationhood. Conversion is a total transformation. And by the way, as halakha is very clear, once somebody converts, you can never unconvert from Judaism. No rabbi can take it away from a convert, and no convert can say later on, oh, I want to go back to where I was or try some other religion. I mean, they could say that. But from that point of view, they're always going to be a Jew. The same way as once you're born, you can't be unborn. Halakha recognizes it exactly the same way. So once somebody converts to Judaism, it's literally the same as one born to Judaism, which means you're now Jewish forever. Judaism does not recognize conversion out. It does not recognize it. Meaning
so
we would say that
if
somebody converted to Christianity, right, Jews have done that.
Yes.
Judaism views that as a Jew who's sinning. We don't say, oh, now you're a Christian. Judaism doesn't recognize the conversion at all, which means, by the way, that if a woman did that, for example, her children are still Jewish. And it matters in terms of very practical law, right? And we say there's no such thing as conversion out, the same way as there's no way to be born out. Once you're born to a Jewish mother, you're Jewish forever. So too, once you convert halakhically, once you follow whatever the protocols are, you're Jewish forever. There's no such thing as reversing that, Rebecca. Well, there's practical consequences. It gets harder and harder to establish proof on a practical level. But theoretically, one who could prove a 6-generation down continual chain of women from this mother, if you could prove it, it gets harder and harder to do, then that person would be Jewish. We still might suggest to somebody born from that who grows up as a Christian or whatever they grow up as, it's worth formally going to the mikvah. Because emotionally, the person didn't grow up with any Jewish identity at all, but there's no halakhic need to do so.
There actually was someone in this circumstance told me that he then went before, a Beit Din and had to say something about returning to the...
That's what we call it, a process of return. And it's actually nice that there's a ritual for it, because honestly, people need ritual. Like just to say, oh, now you're Jewish, it's better to actually do something. Going to a mikvah, standing before a Beit Din and accepting Judaism. The formality of it is emotionally very important, even if the person biologically is Jewish. But there's no halakhic requirement of conversion if we can establish for sure that there's a continual line of women, you know, maternal ancestors starting with a Jewish one. Okay.
The Ethiopians were accepted because they had not had Mishnah.
And they lived apart. Okay, so on this happy note, we're now going to go to the next source, source number 5, because now we're going to talk about procedure. What?
You will be cut off. How do you explain that? Jewish.
You're still Jewish.
How do you explain
that? Okay, so there's a debate what exactly that means, but you're still Jewish. No, nobody thinks that you stop being Jewish by being cut off. So that's the answer. Okay, so source number 5. If a man desires to become a proselyte, for the most part, by the way, whenever it says man, that means man or woman. Okay, humankind. The fundamental difference in procedure, obviously, is one of the big impediments for adult males to go through the process, which is circumcision. In other words, that's the thing that a man must do through a conversion process, and everybody must go to a mikvah. That's the protocol of what must be done. Okay, so if a man desires to become a proselyte, he is to be addressed as follows, meaning he stands before a rabbi in some preliminary meeting, right, in his office somewhere. What reason have you for desiring to become a proselyte? Do you not know that Israel at the present time are persecuted and oppressed, despised, harassed, and overcome by afflictions?
Never changes.
Right. By the way, this Talmudic passage, right, is for all ages, unfortunately. I used to just tell people, I say, do you realize the second you convert, a billion people will hate you and want you dead? Are you sure you want that? It's important. And by the way, what that means is that the very first thing that the rabbi says is becoming Jewish means joining the people. That's the very first thing you can see from the pecking order of how the rabbis in the Talmud talk about this. That nationhood remains paramount to what it means to become Jewish. Okay. If he replies, I know and yet am unworthy, he is accepted forthwith. In other words, if he says, yes, I understand what I'm getting myself into, and I still want it, well, then you accept him as a candidate, and is given instruction in some of the minor and some of the major commandments. In other words, you have to let a person know what you're getting into. Do you realize what it means that you're going to suddenly, now you don't have to keep Shabbat. As soon as you convert, you're a Jew, great, now you're obligated to keep Shabbat. Now you can eat in any restaurant you want. As soon as you convert, you're now obligated to eat in OU glot restaurants. Right, and some will even demand that you have Chol of Yisrael and Pas Yashan, right? Which is certainly not what the law requires, but nonetheless, there are certain stringencies that have made their ways into the, you know, to the packaged goods and restaurant sections everywhere. So that all being said, you have to let the person know what he's getting into. It's not enough to just say, oh, wow, you feel like you're part of the people. Welcome to the family. No, being Jewish is serious business. He is also told of the punishment for the transgression of the commandments. You should realize that you're accountable now. If you convert in, suddenly you're obligated to keep all the mitzvot. And if you don't, God is going to hold you accountable. Right now, you're off the hook. You don't have to do any of these things. You have 7 Noahide laws. All people must do those. You have to be a good, ethical, upright person. But if you convert to Judaism, now you have 613. It's not literally 613. It's a traditional number, and no individual person ever had to keep all 613, right? But collectively, we're obligated by the whole Torah. Furthermore, he is addressed thus. Be it known to you that before you came to this condition, if you had eaten forbidden fat, you would not have been punishable with karet, being cut off. See, Benjamin was waiting for that one. If you had profaned the Sabbath, you would not have been punishable with stoning, because it's violation of Shabbat is a capital offense on the biblical level. We don't practice that anymore, of course, but it was a capital offense in the Torah. And as he is informed of the punishment for the transgression of the commandments, so he is informed of the reward granted for their fulfillment. Okay, you don't want to make it all bleak. You should know, by the way, if you convert, welcome to the family. We're going to embrace you with both arms. You're part of the family, and boy, oh boy, you're now part of the people of Israel. What a privilege. Right? So it's not just, oh man, a lot of people are going to hate you, and you're going to have all these obligations, and if you violate a single one, that could be bad, right? So it's not just the bleak stuff, it's also the good stuff. You want to make sure that there's an encouraging component. If he is accepted, he is circumcised forthwith. And as soon as he is healed, arrangements are made for his immediate ablution. That's what we call the mikvah. So again, with the woman, in other words, everything is the same with the woman until this moment in the passage. And now in this case, it would be the woman doesn't need to go have a circumcision. She can immediately go to the mikvah. Whereas a man, after he's healed from the circumcision, don't do both on the same day usually, but you could, if it's healthy, you can go right to the mikvah. What, right? When two learned men must stand by his side and acquaint him with some of the minor commandments and with some of the major ones. When he comes up after his ablution, he is deemed to be an Israelite in all respects. As soon as you know, here's where you have, if a man is there, so then the rabbinic court just goes right on in there. If it's a woman, obviously for modesty reasons, the men should not be right there, and there are modest ways of doing this, and so that the rabbis are not looking at the woman, obviously. The mikvah lady might be there, that's usually the best method, and the men are out the door, but they're nearby, but don't see anything, and that's what's important. It's important to be respectful and obviously modest. The second the person goes completely under the mikvah and comes back out, you're born again. It's really like a birth. That's the moment when you become part of the people of Israel from here on in, and that's permanent. That transformation is forever. When he comes up after his ablution, he is deemed to be an Israelite in all respects. So what does this passage say, and what does this passage not say? Let's break it up a little bit and see what we have. What does it mean to become Jew? What is the requirement in order to get somebody through the door? That's the question right now. Phyllis?
it doesn't talk about the whole business of having to spend years learning.
Very good. It does not say any time frame. What else doesn't it say? You're right. It doesn't say anything about full observance. In fact, it's very clear. They're not even expecting that the prospective convert knows all of the laws. Saying you have to know a few of the minor ones and a few of the major ones. In other words, you have to give them a sense of what it's about. And we tell them, by the way, when you accept Judaism, you're now obligated in all the mitzvot and you're responsible for them. That's what it says, but what it doesn't say is what Joe just pointed out. It doesn't say, learn all 613 mitzvot first in all of their details, which would take many years. It's very complicated. It would take a very long time. You must learn it all and make sure that you accept to do every single one of those things. It doesn't say anything about what the person promises to do. Right? It just says you need to have some sense. Here are some of the big laws. You have to keep Shabbat. You have to keep kosher. You have to keep family purity laws. Here are some holidays that you have to do. Here are some of the minor ones. Okay. You know, make sure to get the fish bones out in a certain way. You know, there are different things that you got to do. But that's as far as it's going to go in the educational process. And by the way, Rambam, which is outside of the Gemara, Rambam ruled that once we're convinced of the sincerity of a prospective convert, we shouldn't wait too long. Because it'll be a deterrent. It'll be a deterrent. Like at some point, you're like, okay. It becomes a turnoff. Once we think that the person's sincere, don't give them a hard time. We want that's the person we want to welcome into the family. So Rambam was very big on not giving too lengthy of a process. And he made a big deal about that. Very good. Elisa's raising the point that's going to be picked up when we get to source number 7 about sincerity. What does it take to be a sincere, desiring convert? And that's something which is a huge, huge, huge question, particularly for today. Right? Because in the olden days, anybody who wanted to be Jewish was, without even knowing the stories, they were sincere. For a Christian in a Christian land to want to convert, you're risking your life. A Muslim in a Muslim land wanting to convert, risking his life too. In the biblical period, right? Whereas now, obviously, we care very much about what everybody agrees is we want to make sure that somebody who converts really converted according to halacha. And the big fight, which we'll talk about next week. Yeah, that's next week. Next week, we're going to talk about what are the parameters of what are we, what everybody would agree that the best is when you have somebody who is utterly sincere, is doing it all by him or herself. You know, there's no connection to any, you know, they're not doing it for the sake of marriage. They're doing it with the purest of motivations. They're mentally stable. That's key too. It's very important. And that they just study Judaism, fell passionately in love with it, and want to convert, and they plan on doing everything. That's the ideal. Well, let's say we live in a world where a lot of things are not ideal. So what rabbis have to fight about is what's the minimum level that still works? In other words, that's really what a lot of today's fights are about. In other words, if you insist on the maximum, fine, everybody agrees. The maximum is better than the minimum. But the question is, granting difficult, tough situations, what's the minimum needed in order to get somebody through the door? After which point, it's a breach of integrity. In other words, you still need to have integrity. So Elisa's point, you're right. One of the most important words in this passage is so vague, and we need to put some parameters around that vagueness. Now there's another,
what's at stake here is the length of time that this all takes. In other words, if you accept that the person is motivated, if he understands all the problems, that's a relatively simple process.
It sounds like it. And the simplest reading of the source, by the way, fully agrees with you. In the 19th and 20th century, the game gets more complicated for a different reason. And that's what rabbis fight about very passionately beginning in 19th century Germany. So I'll give you a sneak preview to next week, but we're not going to talk about it now because then we'll never be able to, you know, we have to do today, and next week. One of the biggest fights is that there was a presumption in pre-modern times that at least most Jews in most communities are mostly observant. It doesn't mean 100% of everybody, but there's a presumption that when somebody really joins the Jewish community, they're living among people who are keeping Shabbat, keeping Kashrut, going to synagogue, keeping the holidays. There's a framework. What about when most born Jews aren't fully observant? So somebody can say, I want to be Jewish. Well, what does that mean? In the olden days, at least you had some vague, basic sense of what that meant. What does it mean now? A Russian who doesn't believe in God but is fighting in the Israeli army. Okay, is that enough to be Jewish? It's a very important question. And it's very practical, and there's 300,000 of them. I mean, I won't speak for their beliefs in God. I don't know that they all are in the same boat. But many of them are certainly not planning on committing to an observant Jewish lifestyle, but they're serving the Jewish people. So what, today it's very complicated, specifically because of that issue, and then the secondary issue of just having a state of Israel, does that change the game, at least for people living in Israel? Right, so those are the two fundamental sea change questions. Otherwise, you're fundamentally right. Yeah, okay, so by the way, here's one thing that was also missing from this passage, but Rambam wasn't gonna let it go. It doesn't say anything in the passage that we just read about belief at all. It's talking about observance. It talks about nationhood. It talks about some mitzvot. It doesn't say, by the way, you need to believe in one God, and you need to believe in the revelation of the Torah, and you need to believe in all the stuff that you and I discussed in week one. It doesn't say anything about beliefs. So Rambam quickly put that in. Rambam said belief is too central to what it means to be Jewish. It's, quote unquote, it's not enough just to observe the laws mechanically. It's powered by a belief system in one God and an incorporeal God. And Rambam says that's part of the process. He codifies that into his rendering of the laws of conversion because he says that that's too essential of a point. But it's important to note that the Talmud itself doesn't mention belief, but Rambam makes, for him, that's an indispensable part of the package. But still, Phyllis's point is the one that's what next week is going to be about. It doesn't sound like we're talking about a long, drawn-out, several-year-long intensive study course. It sounds like once the person says, you know what, I really want to be here, I want to be part of it, tell me some of the mitzvot, that sounds fine, and I'll learn more as I go along, because we're all on a journey, and there's always a process, and you're not going to be an expert in everything all at once. It sounds like that's enough. Phyllis is right. And then you go through the ritual part of it, which is circumcision for a man, and mikvah for men and for women. Done. That's what it sounds like. There's one caveat that complicated things in a broader way in source number 6. I just want to quote it also. If a heathen is prepared to accept the Torah except one religious law, we must not receive him. If you say, I accept 612 mitzvot, but you know that one about not muzzling an ox when it's threshing? Forget it. Well, that's it, out. We don't accept that person. Rabbi Yosei, son of Rabbi Yehuda, says, even if the exception be one point of the special minutiae of the scribe's enactments. Okay, the question is this passage in sync with the previous one? The previous one said, you say some of the hard ones, some of the easier ones, you talk about general responsibility. Here it says, if you are willing to accept the whole Torah minus one, and even potentially a rabbinic law, that's enough to invalidate the potential of moving forward. Yeah, Rebecca?
So there's a big difference. I mean, in the first case, you just don't know. There's just an absence of knowledge. In the second case, you're saying, this is not, I'm not doing that.
Right.
Well, it also gets to the core of the religion. Start allowing the exception here for this one, a different exception for the other one. After a while, who defines what it is to be a Jew and to have a set of observations?
Right. Observances. Yeah, absolutely. Jack? Okay.
And the second point makes it practically impossible for anybody to defer because, like you said, he keeps going.
Correct. So let me give you two ways to think about this passage, which are debated. I mean, this is what all the fun today is, although it's not really fun. Some of it's very painful, but some of the controversy today revolves around this source. Here's one way to understand this passage. That I plan on observing the whole Torah, but you know, Shabbat is hard. You know, I want to be able to call my parents, you know, Shabbat afternoon. That's the time that they're available. They're awake. We've been speaking for 40 years every Shabbat. I want to give them a call every Shabbat. But I'll do everything else. I'll come to synagogue, I'll have a kosher home. And so one might say, well, this passage says, sorry, we cannot accept you until you're willing to give up that phone call and call before or after Shabbat, right? A second way of reading this passage is, look, I believe that Judaism is Judaism. Whatever you teach me is the Torah. I accept that that's the Torah. I'm not sure if I'm going to observe 100%. What's the difference between A and B are the same. Second one is, after learning about Judaism, I don't think Shabbat prohibits making that phone call. Or I don't think Shabbat really excludes the 39 categories of labor that you taught me in the class.
The real Jew, you question everything. You look at
Right, that means that you should be part of it. The first one has to do with potential laxity in observance, where you're not rejecting Judaism, you're just not sure if you're going to observe 100%. The second one is a fundamental rejection of a piece of Judaism. I accept all of Judaism except belief in one God. I accept all of Judaism except for Shabbat. That means that you're fundamentally rejecting it, and Halakha actually talks about this for Jews also. There are some Jews called Mumar Lahachis, where they reject as a matter of principle a mitzvah. And that's terrible. That means you're rejecting Judaism. It's what George was saying, like who then defines what Judaism is. The second kind is what's called Mumar L'Teavon. You know that there are laws of kashrut, but you like your lobster. So you're not rejecting Judaism, you're just not observing it properly. It's perfectly plausible to read this passage in source number 6. If the prospective convert says, look, I don't know all the laws, but I accept Judaism, that might be more than enough to go in. But if he says, look, you've taught me all these things, I really don't agree with kashrut. I really don't agree with this law. That might be a problem, because that's a matter of a fundamental principled rejection. And that's the key difference, I think, between how two ways of understanding that. Let's move on to source number 7, which is the other very important... Yeah. Of what? I also have no such intention. That's fine, but then you're not violating anything. I also have no intention of owning an ox. You're not... Okay, you only have to fulfill that mitzvah if you have an ox and you're threshing with it. There's no prohibition in not owning an ox. So you're not breaking the Torah. The point is, if somebody says, I believe in cruelty to animals, and I have an ox and I believe that it's right to torture this ox, we might say, okay, well, stay where you are. We don't want you to be Jewish. Jews believe in prohibitions of cruelty to animals. We don't want to torture animals, and the Torah gives certain restrictions on over abuse of animals. There's one other very important passage that we have to look at today, and that's in source number 7. Here's the motivations one. If a man is suspected of intercourse with a Gentile slave who was later emancipated, or with a heathen who subsequently converted, he must not marry her. In other words, if a woman comes to the Beit Din to convert, and she says, look, I really believe in Judaism, and the rabbis are like, look, the reason why you want to convert is because you're having an affair with your boss. So if we convert you, you still can't marry him.
You still want to do it.
Because that would prove that you're sincere. That's the issue. The issue is, it goes back to Elisa's point of the vagueness of sincerity. Here's the sincerity, Gemara. This one's talking about how if the woman genuinely wants to accept Judaism, she doesn't need to marry this man. She should be able to accept it and not marry this man. And since we understand that what the hook was, so this will prove what her motivations are. If all she wants to do is marry the man, and she's going to say the right things and go through a process to be able to marry him. So the law is she cannot marry him. And that will prove her sincerity. If, however, he did marry her, they need not be separated. The rule is, let's say she converted and then they elope and go to Las Vegas. Okay, we still rule that it's a marriage. It wasn't the right thing to do. No rabbi should perform this wedding. But if they went ahead and got married, we recognize the marriage as valid. So this is what this is the sincerity clause, and this is what the Gemara continues with. This implies that she may become a proper proselyte. It means, obviously, if we recognize the marriage, that means that she's Jewish. Because the Jewish law does not recognize an intermarriage. If a Jewish and non-Jewish partner live together as husband and wife, Judaism just says that they're living together. Jewish law doesn't recognize that as a marriage. They say that they're living together. There's no sanctity to this marriage. There's no such thing as marriage for a Jew except to a proper other Jew. So what the Talmud derives from the Mishnah is that if we recognize the marriage as a marriage, that means that she's Jewish, that the conversion counts. But against this, a contradiction is raised. Both a man who became a proselyte for the sake of a woman and a woman who became a proselyte for the sake of a man are no proper proselytes. These are the words of Rabbi Nehemiah. Rabbi Nehemiah's view was that if somebody converts for the sake of marriage, even after the fact, it's not a marriage. It's not a conversion, excuse me, because it's an impure motivation. There's nothing bad about marriage, but conversion needs to be sincere for the sake of heaven. So Rabbi Nehemiah says, if somebody converts for the sake of marriage and they go through the process and the man got a circumcision or the woman went to the mikvah, we don't recognize the conversion at all. Nothing happened. Okay, that's Rabbi Nehemiah's view. It was stated that Rabbi Isaac Bar Shmuel, Bar Martha, said in the name of Rav, the halakha is in accordance with the opinion of him who maintained that they were all proper proselytes. The law is not like Rabbi Nehemiah. According to Rabbi Nehemiah, every prospective convert must be sincere, and if they're not, the conversion is invalid. But according to the majority view and the law, it counts. It's not ideal. Somebody converts for the sake of marriage rather than just purely for the sake of heaven. It's not ideal, but it counts. This law is extremely important today when intermarriage rates are sky high. And we all would agree, it's not ideal if an interdating couple comes before a Beit Din. A lot of things are not ideal already. But the point is that if a conversion happened, the conversion is recognized by Jewish law. That's very important and is going to play an important role next week. But then we also have one final dimension for today, and that is Rambam. Of course, who else? There's something called rabbinic responsa. What are responsa? Responsa are when somebody asks a real question. In other words, Rambam wrote a code, which is normally what we quote. A code is theoretical. A code takes all the halachic teachings and writes in theoretical terms, here is the law. That's what codes are. Responsa are when you go to a rabbi and say, here's a real situation on the ground, what should I do? And the rabbi responds. So that's a responsa. He's not responding in a theoretical sense. It's no longer a theoretical code or discourse or abstract conversation. It's that there are real people really in front of you with a real tough situation. And so this situation happened in the 12th century. Lo and behold, another scandal in the community. Some Jewish man was having an affair with his Christian maid. That's the story. And they're living together. So the community is bursting with scandal. Everybody loves to talk about this stuff. Here it is. That's the scandal of the 12th century. So somebody writes to Rambam, what should happen here? It's a real case. So what do you think it should be based on what we just learned? Jewish man's living with a Christian woman. They're living together, having their affair. The man doesn't seem very deterred by any of this. He seems to be enjoying himself. She's hopefully enjoying herself too. Fine. Now what do we do as a community? But if you ask her to convert, let's go back to source number 7, the first paragraph, right? If a man is suspected of intercourse with a Gentile slave who was later emancipated, or with a heathen who subsequently converted, he must not marry her. So what should be the law? Black on white. Even if she converts, he can't marry her. It's very clear from the Mishnah that even if she goes through a proper process of conversion, this man must not marry her. Some other Jewish man would be able to, by the way. Right? In other words, she can convert and let her marry somebody else. But the rule is she can't marry him because he was the hook. And that makes it insincere. So that's a black on white Mishnah, very clear ruling. So they ask Rambam, what do we do in this situation where the man is living together with this woman? They want to be together. So even a conversion won't allow them to get married. So Rambam said, okay, let's see. Evil number one. Right now, there's an illicit affair going on in the community. That's bad. So that can't keep going on. They can't live together. This is wrong. Bad number two. If she converts, obviously they want to get married. She doesn't want to marry another guy. She likes him. So evil number two is, if she converts, she'll probably end up marrying this guy, even if that's against halacha. So these are the two evils. So which is the lesser of the two evils? You understand, this isn't about what's the ideal halacha. We understand that given a reality, that these two people are attached, these two people are having their affair, these two people plan on getting married, and if she converted, there's no question in anybody's mind, she's going to marry him, she's not going to want to marry man number two. So what's the lesser of the two evils? Which is a very different question from what is the ideal law? Yeah? So that's what happened. Rambam said she should convert, we should do the conversion, and they should get married. We might not want to do the marriage, but he said, granting that these two people are obviously attached, granting that here are the facts on the ground of this case. So I know the law. Rambam, you know, you didn't need to be a brilliant man like Rambam to know the law. It's an explicit Mishnah. Here's our case. It's a case study in the Mishnah that even if she converts, she cannot marry the man. Rambam said it's better that she convert and marry this man than for them to remain together in sin. This, what's the lesser of the two evils question, is of immense relevance to today, when we live in a far from perfect Jewish world. Right? In other words, we're not talking about what would we like to see. We're talking about, given what we see, and it's pretty ugly from a Jewish point of view, what are the lesser of the two evils? So this precedent of Rambam's responsum, that's a singular for responsa, his responsum on this case is something that is regularly quoted beginning in the 19th century, because people understand we live in a world where there's so much assimilation, where there are non-Orthodox rabbis perfectly willing to do a lot of these conversions, where there's intermarriage, where there's civil marriage, which means that, you know, that couple in the medieval period, they had to go through the rabbi. But today, they could just get civil, they can go to a judge and done with it. They could live together as husband and wife. They don't need any rabbi, right? And in Israel, they'll sneak over to Cyprus and get married anyway and then come back. And Israel will recognize it. That's what happens. So we're not living in a world where everybody's under a tight, traditional, communal, rabbinic structure. So we have a mess, and the question is how to best handle the mess. So just to summarize what the principles for today are, and then we'll wrap it up. Here are some of the principles that we learned from the classical sources. And the next week, it gets harder, because next week we have to apply it to reality, right? The theoretical premises are, one, a halakhic convert becomes fully and irreversibly Jewish. Once somebody converts according to halakha, that person is born, and you can't be unborn, right? This person has a halakhic rebirth. That's point number one. Point number two is that ritually, a man requires circumcision and mikvah. These are non-negotiable, and a woman requires mikvah. If those things did not happen, there's no conversion happened. You have that ritual component of it. The vague part, I mean, Elisa's right, it's vague. The candidate must accept Judaism. What does that mean, right? They have to accept that they're becoming Jewish, and with that comes Judaism. Part of it is they accept nationhood. It's not a lone wolf situation, right? Part of it is that you need to understand you're becoming part of the people. And similarly, you become part of the Jewish community. We also need to teach a convert that Judaism has observances and beliefs. There's no rule that the convert must proclaim commitment to all of the Torah, but there is a rule that the convert needs to know that there are rules and that there's a responsibility if one comes in. A convert need not learn all the mitzvot before conversion. That's very clear. There's no mention of a prolonged period of study, and in fact, Rambam specifically discouraged that. Conversion is even valid according to different sources that you and I did not look at today. If the person never even heard of Shabbat, a Beit Din is not doing a good job if they didn't tell a prospective convert about Shabbat. But if somebody converted to Judaism with a valid Beit Din and never even heard of Shabbat, the conversion still is valid. And somebody better teach them about Shabbat very quickly, because they're now obligated to keep it as a Jew. But the conversion itself counts. And a convert should not reject in principle anything of Judaism. They might not observe everything, but they must not reject in principle. I accept all of Judaism except for Shabbat, or except for our beliefs, or except for this, or except for that. That they cannot do. A convert must want to convert for sincere reasons, which is an incredibly vague term. But nonetheless, there has to be some element of, I really want to accept Judaism. And it's an acceptance of Judaism rather than purely for some other motivation. The most common one in our world is marriage. That's the most common one. But theoretically, let's say they think that all Jews are rich, and they have this horrible stereotype, I wish all Jews were rich. But let's say they thought, oh, I better become Jewish, and that way my stocks will all go up. Okay, so that's an impure motivation. I haven't met as many people who wanted to convert for that reason, admittedly. But if somebody came for that sort of reason, that also is an insincere motivation. There has to be some vague sense of wanting to actually adopt Judaism. But if somebody does convert for an impure reason, such as wanting your stocks to go up or to get married,
citizenship,
which is, that's correct. The 20th century, a lot of things have changed because of Israel, citizenship. Then the conversion is valid. In other words, we don't rule like Rabbi Nehemiah, who says that you need to have sincere motives or it doesn't even count. It does count, even though it's not the ideal. And then, and this is the important other tricky part that we'll have to juggle next week, there are times when reality, very often, times create two evils. And a Beit Din needs to decide what is the lesser of the two evils. In other words, we live in a reality where we can't always get the ideal.
If I may, obviously one reads about the constant fights going on in Israel over conversions. if this is in effect a way around it, or you've created a lesser evil, but you're still accepted, what does the Orthodox community then say to the Reform and the conservatives who say we want to perform marriages in Israel?
Right, but that's a, non-Orthodox movements, which we'll talk about next week, opened up a totally different can of worms, which is that the rabbis themselves are not committed to halakha. Which we're no longer talking about if a prospective convert isn't necessarily going to observe everything, but the Beit Din itself believes in the system. But we're talking about where the rabbis themselves, the very Beit Din, isn't committed to the same halakhic concept that, that Judaism always has been. That's what creates a separate layer of complications, and it affects conversions very directly. It affects marriages in a way a little less. Why? Because even if the marriage is not halakhic, if they then go on to live together as husband and wife and they're both Jews, halakha might recognize that de facto as marriage. Right? In other words, that theoretically, if they got divorced, they would still need a get. That's what matters. But then the question is if they don't get a get. So that's a whole different can of worms. We'll talk about that because it's very... I might mention it in passing. But in other words, that was a social ordinance designed to protect the entire community against interdating, basically. They're saying if you even get into this mess, you're going to be out of the community altogether, which is a strategy. It's not a halakhic position. It's a strategy for combating intermarriage. I'm more interested in the halakha, which I don't think the Syrians would say it's... That,
it has implications for halakha because when they encounter a convert, they then have certain ways of dealing with that.
Right. Understood, but that's a social ordinance. In other words, they're still not disagreeing with the halakha. It was a social ordinance which they thought was strategically better of protecting the integrity of the community, for better and for worse. What I'm interested in is, okay, granting that ordinance and whether or not that has is strategically sound, okay, but there is conversion in halakha, and I'm pro-conversion when it's done properly. And so, but what does it mean? So today we dealt with the classical sources and the principles that emerge from it, and then next week is the can of worms, and what we're going to do next week, because it's our last session of this course, is deal with modernity and conversion, and then I'm going to try to save up some 10 minutes at the end for just what we talked about a little bit, the Sephardic communal model, just giving a sense of what an open and inclusive Judaism can look like that at least best accommodates the various strands that we've been discussing, even though, you know, you can't solve all the problems of the universe, but at least a model that could be very helpful for making the Jewish community better. So on that happy note, I wish you all a good week and stay dry. I'm going to hit stop, but feel free to keep asking.